Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Media Voices podcast. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Coming up this week, we are looking at the Cairncross review. We are looking at Apple's offer to split revenue 50-50 with publishers. And we're looking at GQ Hype, which I think Esther is very excited to talk about.
Not as excited as you are, apparently, when we're recording on Friday night and
yeah,
not on
I
Sunday
guess.
Morning.
We need to start recording at night, man. You're like a different human.
But yeah, Esther, who did you talk to this week?
So this week I spoke to magazine marketing agency Magnetics. I spoke to their CEO, Sue Todd. They've just launched their Pay Attention campaign, which is looking to highlight the importance of quality attention to advertisers. So we talked about some of the educational issues around media buyers, where the problems lie in ad spend and media planning, and also why she believes that magazine media is undervalued.
First, though, we're going to be talking about the biggest news of this week. Katy Perry has teased an engagement to Orlando Bloom.
I can't even process that.
I know. To begin with, though, the Cairncross review. So we got our first real look at Dame Frances Cairncross's look at news provision in the UK, following her being appointed chair of the review into the sustainability of high quality journalism in March of last year.
I feel like this is Chris looked at the Cairncross review and neither of us did.
Well,
Chris read the Cairncross review, so no one else had to.
No, but that was the thing. Everybody saw it. And then in the couple of days since, there's been a lot more nuance in terms of what people have found by looking through it. For the most part, though, it is a very good, almost primer to the state of the UK media. So everything we talk about week in, week out, it's been sort of elucidated in this report. So the business model of digital journalism doesn't necessarily support high quality news in the way it once did. And digital advertising and platforms might have a role to play in the decline of traditional journalism. SDS.
So, Chris, if other people haven't read this, mm-hmm. and I'm sure we're not the only ones, what are the key recommendations you would take away from it?
Right. So, firstly, that new codes of conduct to balance the relationship between publishers and online platforms be drawn up. That sounds easy. No, there's never been any contention between those two.
Is it Nick Clegg already working on that?
Yeah, he's already settling that for us, so we don't have to worry about that one. He needs to investigate the online advertising market to ensure there's fair competition. We don't need to worry about terms like fair when it comes to this. Third, online platforms' efforts to improve their users' news experiences should be placed under regulatory supervision in order to ensure a quality context and to alleviate the issue of online misinformation. The government should develop a media literacy strategy. Well, good fucking luck with that one.
Well, I'd love to know what that meant as well, but is that just in schools? Or are we going to have special outreach programs for the Daily Mail readers?
This needs to be in nursing homes. Kids are not the problem here.
They're certainly not the ones who are sharing fake news more often. So Ofcom also needs to explore the BBC's market impact to ensure it doesn't extend beyond its remit and negatively impact local news publishers. That one is absolutely on the money. The BBC is kind of a lead weight on the ability of local news publishers to
make money. Know what? You're going to come to another recommendation that absolutely contradicts this.
Well, yeah, because...
Keep going.
I will. Flag it up. It recommends also that a government fund should be set up focused particularly on innovations aimed at improving the supply of public interest news. It also recommends that new forms of tax relief be introduced, also the scrapping of the 20% VAT on digital news subscriptions, which would then bring online paywalls in line with printed newspapers, which has been relatively universally applauded. I think we can all agree that that's a very outdated idea in the first place. And it recommends direct funding for local public interest news, in part to alleviate the lack of accurate local news.
Oh, let me see. You mean like a license?
Well, yeah. And then finally, it recommends, and this one's the easiest of all, it recommends the establishment of an Institute for Public Interest News, effectively a council that gets to determine where a lot of the funding would go. It's a very sweeping set of recommendations,
each point of which would
take 100 years to sort out.
It's too easy to have a go at this. Mm. And that's absolutely the wrong way to approach it. You know, at least they set up this inquiry and they put some decent people in and they got some great feedback.
They did.
As far as I can see. And some of these are really, really hard, but it's important to raise them.
Yeah, certainly. This is almost a wish list of what should be done rather than a checklist of how we achieve it.
That's not crap on the Cairn Cross Review.
No, like I said, people were very, very favourable towards it for the most part. I think that there's a very strong statement in there, possibly the strongest statement, is, quote, given the evidence of a market failure in the supply of public interest news, public intervention may be the only remedy.
But it's not really the job of the Review to fix the problem. Someone else has got to take this and run with it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem
is that going to be?
Well, this is the issue. Every single part of it, Nick Clegg will do it. But every single part of it does imply that somebody will then come and pick up the reins. And obviously, if you look at the news ecosystem, look at how diverse it is. So, I mean, crucially, here's just one example of that. Jim Watson over at The Guardian pointed this out. The Review only says that high quality journalism needs to be protected, not that the newspaper industry as it is needs to be saved. And only I really only saw The Telegraph pick up on this. So the report states that although the revolution is not yet over...
Irony.
Yeah, the trajectory is clear. Readers have moved online and are unlikely to come back to print. Now try getting somebody like Reach to get behind that initiative, to get them to say, you know what, yeah, let's just go digital only. Which comes down to the sort of the central issue with the Review, which is how do you determine and who determines what is high quality in this sense and what deserves protecting?
Oh, so... On one level, high-quality journalism is pretty easy to define. It's taught in every journalism school in the country or around the world. You know, it's accuracy. It's about good sourcing. It's about balanced reporting. You know, that's not the point. The point is to come away from some of the hysteria that is overlaid on a lot of the stuff that gets put in British newspapers and newspaper websites.
But who's the arbiter then of what the division is? Because I think that the Mail, at least they would pay lip service to the idea that a lot of what gets published on Mail Online is quality journalism, even though we know that it's not.
Are we talking about high quality journalism? Or are we talking about news? Or are we talking about celebrity bullshit that gets pumped out of some of these websites?
The answer to that is yes, we are.
Okay, well, yeah, then that's a nightmare.
But I have yet to see anybody come up with... Yeah, do you know what? The revenue with everything going to Facebook and Google and the way that balance is, it doesn't work. Everybody acknowledges it doesn't work. But I have yet to see anybody, including this Review, come up with a sensible suggestion as to how you remedy that. You know, Article 13's trying, but that in itself is hugely, hugely problematic. It's such a complex problem that... Yeah, I haven't seen any answers to how you can really address that.
This doesn't really get at the local aspect, does it?
Some parts did. It recommended the expansion of the BBC local journalism scheme, which has been quite well received. Peter, you mentioned the fact that the licence fee is effectively what should be funding this anyway. Just as a final thing on this then before we move on, props to Mark DiStefano of BuzzFeed who went through and he found that DMG Media, the publishers of Mail Online, had argued for a, quote, copyright and licensing scheme to secure high-quality journalism. And he went on to say, I mean, it feels like they've really voted to chop their own legs off there.
So continuing to look at money and how publishing gets funded... Apple has stirred up a whole heap of shit by offering to keep half of publishers' revenue from its new news subscription service. This is basically Apple News, which I guess allegedly drives more traffic to publishers than Facebook these days and is read by 90 million people, according to a New York Times article. They're basically trying to introduce, I'm so done with this, a Netflix for news scheme. At least it's not a Spotify for news scheme. They remember a while back they bought, what's that company called?
Texture.
Digital magazine company. Lots of subscription technology. And they're building that into Apple News, coming up with a new subscription model. The problem with Apple News... is that, well, it's two problems. There's the age-old money problem. There's not enough ad sales on it because Apple doesn't spend enough time selling ads. And publishers are trying to sell ads without any data. So that doesn't deliver a lot of revenue. And then the other side of it is the age-old scale versus traffic conundrum. So publishers on Apple News might get loads and loads and loads of exposure if they make it to the front page, but they can't follow up because, just like Joey with food, Apple doesn't share data.
I get that reference.
Yay! So hoping that subscriptions are going to be the answer, publishers have started trying to push subscriptions through Apple News using Apple's own payment tech for a 30% cut. Some people say that's going okay. But now Apple has come up with this Spotify, Netflix, Blue Apron aggregation model where they want it to be different. They want to take half the revenue, not 30%, and they want to share the rest between all the publishers on the platform based on how much traffic or engagement they get. That could be brilliant for consumers. They can kind of avoid subscription fatigue in a similar way, I guess, that people do on platforms like Readly. So they pay whatever it is, $9.99 a month, and they can read every platform or every magazine or newspaper on the platform. So massive range of content on their screens. But it is a nightmare. If it's true, it's a nightmare for publishers.
Yeah. This is, I think, what needs to be said first off. These are rumours. Apple has offered, well, Apple never offered comment, but all the sources quoted, just sort of people familiar with the matter. Mm. And Apple are unlikely to comment until their launch event in March.
And Esther, even though these are just rumours, as you mentioned, what was the publisher reaction to this? I imagine it was broadly favourable, right?
Oh my word, you could barely move on Twitter for people squawking about this. And to be fair, it's like every issue we seem to discuss, it's hugely problematic. But I think, again, this is something that news publishers and magazine publishers have very, very different reactions to, understandably. You know, if you're the Times, if you're the Wall Street Journal, if you're these news publishers that have these paywalls that are $10, $15 a month, that you would be insane to go for this, because the revenue per reader is going to be fractional for this kind of thing. Unless Apple suddenly launched with, you know, a couple of million, billion users, what you're going to get from this is negligible. But for magazines who have got a lot of their content free online, people like Condé Nast who are looking at putting paywalls up on other stuff, actually, this is a real opportunity. I see Peter shaking his head, which is why I think that the success of this will be how they manage to split it out from Apple News, because I've heard rumors again it's supposed to be Apple magazines. Mm. If it's a choice between making no revenue online or making revenue through your ads and getting a bit from this, it's that question: is a bit from Apple better than nothing?
You sound like fucking to me. A no deal's better than a bad deal, for Christ's sake. Who makes no revenue online?
Well, Esther brought up the fact that news content, as you know, as currently on Apple News, is inherently different than magazine content. For one thing, a lot of news content is effectively clones of the other existing news content. That's why people rush to get it out. Whereas magazine content is a lot more bespoke for the most part. So this would work a lot better for magazines.
I mean, you know, things like Readly have done all right.
But remember how this works, okay? Yeah, it's a rumor. It's absolutely a rumor. But what happens is Apple takes a percentage, and then the magazine publishers take a share of a percentage, dependent on how much time you're on there.
Yeah.
Which means Hello, Chat, and some other celebrity bullshit magazines are likely to get possibly more revenue than Fly Fishing Monthly.
Okay, but just to play devil's avocado here, we don't know enough about this yet. And, if you read the Stratechery article that is specifically about this,
which is very good,
it is very good. It mentions that Apple News currently is actually helpful in pushing a lot of subscriptions, and so there is the potential here to do both, you know, rev share and direct selling of subscriptions. So it's not necessarily an either or sort of thing.
Yeah, but how? Nah. How's that going to work? You're competing with everyone else on that platform for attention.
You're doing exactly the same on a newsstand. Your magazine is competing with everybody else for attention.
Yeah, but you get to control battle cover. You know who buys it, because the newsstand guy will share his bastard data with you if you ask.
So I see you've put an animated GIF into the news roundup this week.
Run away!
All the criticism I've seen here has not been of the model Apple are trying to use. Like, you know, we've seen hundreds of think pieces on how we need the next Spotify or Netflix for news. People have said it's not the model here that's the problem. It's this 50% revenue share.
Yeah.
And at that point, publishers actually have a huge amount of power in their hands. If they all say to Apple, you know, absolutely jog on, Apple has no business. And if enough people do that, this is the thing. This is why actually people need to come together and go to Apple and say, this is not acceptable. You know, the power is in the publisher's hands at this point.
Well, militancy from Esther. I like it.
We need to defend our borders.
True leadership from the Theresa May of the podcast.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I've been quite aggressive in saying this is not a good idea. I love Spotify. I subscribe to Spotify. I spend money with Spotify every month.
Yeah.
As a consumer, Spotify is brilliant. As a consumer of content, this might be absolutely brilliant. Someone somewhere has got to figure out how are the publishers going to make some kind of decent money on this.
I think now's the time to move on because it's getting depressing. Esther, do you want to introduce this next story for us?
So British GQ has decided to kind of sneakily launch a youth title. I don't know if that's the right way to describe it. Anyway, it's targeting new younger audiences with GQ hype. Peter, we ended up having a bit of a debate about this on Twitter, didn't we?
A little bit, yeah. You know, I've got no issue with what GQ's done with this. I really don't. In January, they put out 280 articles on hype. It's a separate section on the GQ website. They're going to launch a newsletter this month. Dylan Jones has said Condé Nast is committed to it. They're not just putting 800-word pieces on it. There's some real in-depth reporting going in. But he himself calls it a free-to-air weekly. And in the same piece, he talks about how desperate he is to get people paying for content. He says, I sincerely hope we reach a stage when everything is behind a paywall. It's kind of outrageous that people get things for free. And, you know, there's the cognitive dissonance of the media publishing industry is just laid bare in that sentence or in this story.
Well, there's free, as in free forever, and then there's investment. You know, there's, you know, to quote the villain of Fargo season 3, there's continuity and there's singularity. And if they just gave this out for free forever, then absolutely, that doesn't make any sense with what he's saying. But if this is seen as a way to convert people to paid eventually, in the same way that the NYT's 3 million student subs is, does that not make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I actually really like this when I read about it. I thought it was quite smart. They've almost approached it a bit like a kind of marketing strategy.
Mm.
Like, you know, if GQ's going up behind a paywall at some point, British isn't yet, but if Condé roll out their plans to the UK as well, then this is a way to reach out to that younger audience. And I don't know the average age of a GQ reader, but it does make sense that if you want to segue that younger age group into it, this is a really smart thing to do. But it's one of those things that if more publishers put up paywalls, could we see kind of new little micro sites like this popping up to try and segue people into it?
Yeah, very possibly. I mean, if you read the Digiday article, which we've linked to in the news roundup, which also quotes Alex de Groot, always good to see his name there. He's talking, well, the article talks about how it might eventually do exactly that, because what with the kind of the closure of Shortlist and, you know, the kind of the bloodbath that's going on in Men's Weekly Free at the moment, very possibly we are going to see more endeavours like this pop up.
I still struggle with this. Like the Tory party, publishers are trying to hold these two contradictory thoughts in their head at the same time. That we can give stuff away for free and we can charge people. There's a balancing act there that's difficult.
I think really though, you can't just flip the switch. You can't go, hey, you're habituated to free, now you got to pay for everything, because you're going to lose people. Peter, you were talking about Spotify earlier. You pay weekly for Spotify. Did you have a free trial or did you go straight to premium?
I had a free trial, but not for long. This isn't... No, you're missing my point. You're absolutely missing my point.
Okay.
Condé Nast is committed to not just putting 800 word pieces of free to air content in here. They're putting serious journalism behind this. They've got new hires and all sorts going on. This is a real project.
Is a substantial investment as well.
Yeah. So if I'm a GQ kind of guy and I want to read, I'm never going to read 280 articles in a month. So I don't have to pay for anything.
So you're saying that they've got the balance wrong. They're saying that there's no incentive for people to pay if all they want is this GQ hype stuff.
I'm not actually commenting specifically on GQ. I'm using GQ as an example of the absolute difficulty that people, that publishers are having to face here in terms of achieving exactly what Esther said. This is a great marketing play. But how do you draw the line between a marketing, like the Irish border, how do you draw the line between the marketing play and the paywall? It's impossible. It's a difficult.
I think you've got to give people enough to want to sign up for the paid stuff, but not so much that they feel like they don't have to, surely.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that's 280 articles and serious, deep content.
No, I mean, Spotify was 5 songs.
There you go.
So Media Voices is a labour of love for us. But one thing we found helps enormously is Trint, which is an automated tool that takes hours of transcription off our plates and lets us spend time on the important aspects of putting a podcast together. So if you'd like your own go on Trint, please do sign up to our newsletter, which includes a link to a free trial. You can sign up by going to voices.media, that's voices.media, and on top of that, it's just a damn good newsletter as well.
This week, I spoke to Magnetics CEO Sue Todd about a campaign they've just launched where special issues of well-known UK magazines like Cosmo, Empire, Radio Times and a bunch more, they're carrying special covers about how magazines deliver high-quality attention for exceptional ad value. So the special magazines are being distributed to media agencies and clients around the UK. So I started by asking Sue about the thinking behind the campaign and what they're aiming to change with it.
I guess in a nutshell, we felt last year we did a piece of work where we asked some of the ad communities and planners and some customers for what they thought about magazines, and at the same time we saw a piece of work that Ubiquity and the Radio Centre had done, and it confirmed what we felt, that there was a gap between what the evidence said about how magazines deliver in terms of effectiveness, ROI for brands and clients, and what the perception was amongst some of the planning community and clients. And we felt that we needed to, in a more bold and unified way, come together and share what we thought was the core proposition and really hopefully simplified answer to why should magazines be on a modern communications plan. So the pay attention work was based on some research that we did with PhD in Bournemouth University that really supported what was true of printed magazines, particularly even 10 years ago, that we offer this undivided immersive attention to the advertising, and it reinforced that. But it gave us new context, because obviously the world's changed in 10 years and we all know that, you know, the evidence tells us, you know, in terms of the time we're spending and the way we're consuming content, that, you know, there are probably less of those undistracted, undivided attention moments. So we thought it was a good time to reassert and tell in hopefully a compelling way with some advocates from the client and agency community on our behalf that story. So that's what the work was about in essence. And we used our own media and we used trade press to tell that story. And we thought it was important to use print and also to support it digitally. And we ran a competition in agencies to activate it. And we're on a sort of long journey, I guess, a long-term journey to try and change the conversation about the value of what we call quality attention environments, of which magazines in print particularly perform really strongly. I mean, you know, the advertising is part of the experience, consumers love it, the product is weaker when you take the ads out as far as the consumer's concerned, and we think we have to tell that story to all the people in the sort of planning, buying and client community in a much sort of louder and more bold way, because I think it's time for a reappraisal. Bournemouth did a white paper for us just to give us an appraisal of the current thinking, and then PhD helped us with a new piece of work and a new framework that we thought was a nice way of thinking about attention, to try and then consider the role that various channels and various media play within it. And of course, we're only at phase one of this piece of work. We're sort of determined that we're going to, on an ongoing basis, try and investigate more. And, you know, so things like at the moment, we've taken no account of the power of creative within the channels, because clearly, you know, we can see from the research that, you know, magazines do perform really well, as cinema does, and you know, news brands to a certain extent, in terms of commanding consumers' attention. We know that cinema and magazines particularly do particularly well when it comes to attention to the advertising. But then, of course, an amazing piece of creative can bowl through all of that and, you know, grab our attention and perform really well and, you know, get the consumer to really care and log that brand in their memory. So it's only one stage so far, but we think it's an important conversation. And I think the broad point about quality attention environments being undervalued is sort of where we'd like to check, we'd like to have the conversation ongoing with clients and brands. But this is a launch to say, look, the world's changing, and something about print, we think particularly, is being undervalued.
And what would you say when you're talking to some agencies about this? What are some of the misconceptions? Well, I think you'd see them as misconceptions that they have around perhaps not deciding to put print on media plans.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a few pieces of work that have told us different things. I think the Ubiquity Radio Centre work showed that although magazines were third in their table on ROI, I think we were perceived to be bottom or second bottom on that particular metric by planners. So we've clearly not told the story clearly enough about how and why magazines deliver. So although we have created a wealth of evidence over the last 3 to 5 years, and I think this is, you know, we've done our own work, but so have all the trade bodies, and the IPA really stepped things up in terms of effectiveness work too. So I think across the board, there's more evidence than ever about how and why various channels perform together and separately. So I think there's tons of evidence, but for some reason that's not quite resonating. I think part of the challenge with print, which is why we sort of unashamedly focused on print with this piece of work, is that the narrative has been for a few years that, you know, print is in terminal decline, and some of the figures that come out from things like the ABCs, I think, have grabbed a lot of headlines. And, you know, when there's a closure in the magazine print environment, you get, you know, the enemy, you know, you get a lot of headlines of Glamour or the enemy, or a very long-standing and well-known brand does close its print channel. And, you know, the launches that are happening in magazines don't grab as many headlines. You know, we don't see that. And although, of course, there is definitely changes in growth digitally for magazine brands, and PAMCO, our sort of gold standard audience currency, shows really well where, for some of the younger audiences, that digital growth's coming. The reality is that I think perception-wise, people feel that, you know, the decline in print is happening faster than it actually is. And if you look at the correlation between the decline in circulation and the decline in ad revenue, the gap is wider. So, you know, the ad revenues decline faster than print circulations have. So I guess those sort of facts drove us to think that, you know, some of the headlines are disproportionately, among some parts maybe of the sort of buying and planning community, driving a perception that, you know, we don't hold much value. Yet the evidence says the ROI and the work, the role we play is still strong. So it just felt that we needed to just unify and come together and tell that story as one sector.
And Magnetic as an agency is now 3 years old. What are some of the key things you've achieved in that time? And when you were formed, what were you kind of set up to do?
Well, I mean, I think the key brief was, like it is for all of the various marketing agencies, was to ensure that we did have a unified voice, and to ensure that some of the commercial messages that are common to us all were evidenced and resonated amongst the client and sort of agency community. I think over the 3 years, the thing we had to do first was to genuinely build more evidence. So we did spend quite a lot of time making sure that the most obvious objection that we could face, there's not enough proof, there's not enough evidence, you haven't invested enough in effectiveness research, we're not sure what your purpose is anymore, was sort of overcome. So we've done a lot of big research projects in collaboration with various agencies. You know, we did a piece of work with Mediacom on trust last year, we did a piece the year before with Cara called Metrics That Matter, that really tried to get under the skin of the way that magazines supported driving brand KPIs. We did a piece of work, the IPA, which, you know, nearly all sort of marketing bodies and trade bodies have also done, where we asked Peter to unpick and isolate from the IPA database what the effect was of the contribution that magazines were making, where we found out that, you know, customer acquisition was a huge strength in terms of, you know, the contribution we're making, as was driving top line sort of revenue for brands. But also we found that we could write the other end of the funnel, drive, you know, activation as well. So I think we had to build that body of evidence. And I think that's taken us a couple of years to get to the point where we go, that objection, which people used to level at us, of saying there's not enough evidence, we don't understand the role you play. We could say, well, there's tons of evidence. And there's actually tons of evidence from other people about our channel too. Thinkbox did a piece of work last year, which was well recognised as being very helpful, I think, in the effectiveness debate around profitability and the return that various channels offered for brands to profit. And, you know, print, which of course was newspapers and magazines, was second only to telly in terms of driving profit for in the short term, according to Thinkbox's work. So I think we wanted to get that bit done first. And although the job of proving to individual clients is never done, and obviously we can't stand still because the world around us changes continuously, and we have to always evidence and always support anyone who wants us to help them prove or isolate or better understand the contribution that we make, and that job's not finished. I think we felt that, you know, we'd built up enough of a body of work to feel more confident about the role we play, which is why it feels like the right time for us to be a little bit more on the front foot with a sort of campaign and a unified message around quality attention. And I think the second part of that campaign is that we also wanted to remind people about the great value that, you know, magazines are. We've done some work in the report that we published on our microsite around average cost per thousands, which is the bit of kind of planning and buying that, you know, I guess no one really talks about particularly publicly, but the reality is that we wanted to remind people that we're great value for this amazing quality attention. The exchange is a good one. So after 3 years, make sure every publisher that's a Magnetic member felt comfortable that was something they could support, which they do. And, you know, get behind sharing it and evidencing it and continuously kind of talking about and trying to change the conversation around quality attention and the role that we play.
So what would success look like for this campaign?
Well, I mean, I think in the short term, it's about hopefully just get some cut through because, you know, we're 3% media. So, you know, and there are lots and lots and lots of individual medias and channels who are out telling their story too, rightly so. So I think, you know, short term, we're just pleased that the engagement with the campaign has been pretty high. But over the medium to long term, I mean, we've got a job to do to go in and talk to individual planners and individual agencies and individual clients about how we can work with them on them potentially using the channel to greater effect, which, you know, we will do over the next 6 to 9 months with the current research we've got from PhD and the second phase, which is coming out in June. So I think, you know, it's a slow burn for us in the sense that, you know, we're quite happy to accept that, you know, there's a number of people we'd like to go and talk to, and ultimately, you know, via the sales teams and the publishers together, you know, we need to go and knock on a few doors and say, can we come in and talk to you about this? What do you think? I guess the slightly bigger KPI around it is if we can start a debate amongst the industry about how we maybe move away from just thinking about reach and eyeballs and scale as being, you know, the most important way that we measure the performance and the value of channels. So it's really difficult because there's never going to be one metric that says quality of attention is X, Y, and Z. But, you know, there is no one single answer to this, I don't think. So it's not simple. But I guess a good KPI for us would be if what we call the quality attention environments, and that debate was being had a little bit more publicly, you know, throughout the industry.
And you said earlier that sort of the big problem around this is that ad spend is dropping in magazine media. Where do you see that kind of going, and where is the problem with where that's being funneled away to?
I mean, again, I don't think there's one place. I think, you know, print has probably been the channel that has over the last 10 years, you know, revenue-wise and spend-wise, seen the most decline. But, and I don't think it's going to one place. I mean, clearly, every individual planner and every individual brief is looking to address a different communication challenge. So I don't think there is one answer to that problem. But we also know that, you know, an awful lot of revenue has swung into, you know, the duopoly, into the big digital channels. Much of it, I'm sure, very cleverly planned and for lots of good reasons. So I think there's a piece of work we did last year with Enders about short-termism, tried to take a sort of holistic view of what was clearly going on in the industry in terms of, you know, more money being funneled towards activation rather than maybe what we would classically call brand building, and therefore the channels that were classically known as being strong at brand building, which I think print and magazines in print particularly were always known for. So I think there's dynamics that are far bigger than just media and media choices and planning going on that are driving some of those changes, and many of them I'm sure are very valid for individual campaigns.
And a lot of publishers sort of on the back of this have made serious inroads into diversification. I think that's been the big word last year. And as part of that, the magazine is sort of becomes part of a product mix rather than taking centre stage.
Yeah.
Do you see this move to reduce reliance on advertising as problematic or positive?
I definitely don't think it's problematic, because I think what diversification in terms of both product and revenue shows is that the consumer demand exists for that content and for that brand. So I think if you are a media owner, the most important thing before you even think about your ad revenue is, does the consumer want the content? Are they willing to pay for it? Will they engage with it? You know, can we have a relationship with them in other places? And if the answer to that is yes, then you have a business, a brand, and you're in rude health. So I think it's really positive because it shows the strength of those brands with the consumer. And ultimately, that's what advertising relies on. It relies on the engagement and the relationship and the trust that that consumer has with that brand, regardless of the platform, regardless of the delivery mechanism. So I think I definitely don't think it's problematic. I think it shows a real strength in what the publishers do. But also advertising is still incredibly important to most of the UK consumer publishers. I mean, it's certainly not in any way not still a huge priority. So even with diversification into different channels and even with other revenue e-commerce opportunities, which have obviously been really successful for a number of the publishers, it in no way diminishes the fact that, you know, advertising is still incredibly important. And, you know, the support that they give to me and to the Magnetic team is an indication of the fact that it's still an incredibly important part of what we do and what we offer to brands.
Is that quite challenging? You've got a number of different publishers that have kind of come together with a lot of these initiatives. Is that challenging to bring them together in that way, and do they ever kind of really set aside their competitive differences?
Yeah, definitely. They definitely do. No question. It's difficult only in the sense that, you know, anybody who deals with multi-stakeholder businesses is looking for the points of commonality. And once you've identified what people have in common and where strategically and commercially they're aligned, it's actually really easy. So this campaign has been evidence of that, I think, because it has involved an awful lot of people. It's been an enormous collaboration. I mean, it's for me, I keep saying it's not really a Magnetic campaign. It's definitely a magazine sector industry campaign, of which we have sat at the centre and helped coordinate and lead. But there's no question it's an enormous collaboration and great evidence of how the publishers work together and have very common strategic goals. And I think there's other places where that's true as well. I mean, you know, there's obvious places like PAMCO, which is obviously our relatively new, coming up to its first anniversary, new audience measurement system, which again is obviously also a collaboration with Newsworks, news brands, NMA, IPA, ISBA, etc. So multi-platform JIC. But, again, it's, you know, those sorts of projects, collaborations, investments for me are evidence of more collaboration across the sector than less. And I think that's because, although clearly on a day-to-day basis there is still competition, both on the newsstand with consumers and obviously from an advertising point of view, the reality is that we are better together when it comes to promoting the role that we play to planners, agencies and clients.
And are there any other industry initiatives that you've seen that you think are making a real difference with the perception of magazine media?
Well, PAMCO's definitely helped. So I just mentioned PAMCO, the audience, new audience currency. That's a huge collaboration and is definitely helping us show, you know, total brand reach and the way you can plan across digital and print. And that's really important, because although this particular campaign we were just talking about is led as a sort of a print campaign, the reality is that, you know, we know from other evidence and other research we've done that we also perform digitally really well when it comes to attention against industry averages. So, you know, we clearly need to be able to show in totality what these magazine brands deliver. So one of the projects that I think also shows collaboration and has been a helpful initiative is a project that Dennis, Immediate, Haymarket and Bauer did last year together. Without us, this was not magnetic driven at all, around the power of motoring environments for advertisers. And it got nominated at the Media Week Award. So there are plenty of things that the publisher are doing anyway together, and therefore taking those types of pieces of insight out to clients together, that's nothing to do with magnetic. So I think there's plenty of stuff going on that shows collaboration, both on the kind of measurement side like PAMCO, but also just more specifically in verticals in certain sectors.
And Magnetic itself, it's a UK agency. It's working with a sort of small group of UK publishers. If you're listening in the US, Australia, Europe, the other places we've got listeners, what can publishers do to kind of try and get that message out to agencies that they need to be on their plans? They need to be, you know, print is valuable.
Well, I mean, I see some of the work that gets done with, you know, colleagues in the States and Australia, and they also do really good work. And I know they've unified around certain messages. I mean, I think what we have in common, and where I see most of the commonality, despite market differences, is around the idea of engagement and quality attention, and why that is such a valuable commodity asset for an advertiser. I've seen really good work done around, you know, because we're so trusted by consumers, and therefore create a really safe environment for brands, why that's a really powerful message. I think also just relevancy, and the fact that a lot of the content areas which publishers surround and super serve, and which we in the UK talk about from a passion-based point of view, from, you know, food to photography, fashion to film, are growing. So I think we should feel really confident that the territory and the areas that we serve brilliant content around are really important to people. The delivery mechanisms through which we do that are multivaried, and clearly digital's showing us the potential for growth in younger audiences, but print's more robust than I think people perceive it is. And that what that results in for an advertiser is this enormous and amazing engagement and fantastic quality of attention for exceptional value.
And the last thing we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read or saw which really affected you?
Yeah, two things in the last 2 weeks, actually. I saw an amazing one-woman play at the Trafalgar Studios last week called Black is the Colour of My Voice, which is a one-woman play based on Nina Simone's life, which blew me away. It was really compelling, very emotional, and was a kind of... first half was a play based on Nina Simone's life, and the second half was the actor singing some Nina Simone songs, and it was absolutely blow away amazing. And the second thing is, I'm in the middle of reading Maggie O'Farrell's memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am, which is about the near-death experiences she's had and how they've shaped her life, and it's been really thought-provoking. I cannot put it down, and I'm reading it in print, not on a Kindle.
So if any of you lot are around on Wednesday the 27th of February, the three of us will be at 2020 Publishing in London. We've got a couple of comp tickets to Friends of the Podcast, so if you want one of those, you can sign up to our newsletter, or which you can do on the website at voices.media.
And as always, you can follow us on Twitter. We're there probably more than we should be. You can follow us at Media Voices Pod. Actually, you should sign up for the newsletter as well, you know. It's a good newsletter.
A strong sell. But as ever, until next week, when we are going to be back with another absolutely fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening this week, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.